You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 73, Leviticus 10. I'm your layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you doing this week?
Very good. Glad to be back and to jump into Leviticus again.
Yeah, I'm excited about Leviticus 10. We got some action on this one.
Yeah, I've actually heard from a few people that are enjoying Leviticus. So, you know, I can't diss it. Can't diss it anymore. Got to get away from that.
No, I mean, there's a lot to it that people don't touch these types of books. So I'm glad we're doing it because it's somebody has to.
Yeah, somebody has to.
I mean, the first time I read it, it's just, you just don't absorb it. You just kind of skim through it because it's just so in depth and it doesn't apply. It's just not practical. So There's a lot of people that just don't focus on Leviticus more than just reading it and moving on.
Yeah, I got to get through it so I can say I read the Bible.
Exactly.
Yeah, I know. Well, here in chapter 10, if listeners can recall, this follows the ordination of Aaron and his sons. Last time we talked about, you know, some of the priestly garments and the ceremony associated with, you know, consecrating them and making sure that the tabernacle and the people who minister in the tabernacle were expunged of impurity, again, decontaminated, that sort of thing. And right on the heels of that, we get chapter 10. And we're sort of prepped for this by verses 23 and 24 of the preceding chapter, chapter 9. So I'm going to read those. It says, Moses and Aaron went into the tent of meeting, and when they came out, they blessed the people. And the glory of the Lord appeared to all the people. And fire came out from before the Lord and consumed the burnt offering and the pieces of fat on the altar. And when all the people saw it, they shouted and fell on their faces. So here we have, again, this phrase before the Lord, which we're going to talk about again. It refers to the immediate presence, which we know, again, from preceding material and other biblical passages, was the Holy of Holies inside the tent. So somehow fire comes out, through the structure and the apparatus of the tabernacle, consumes the offering, and basically it's a signal that, you know, everything's okay. Everything's decontaminated. We're all set to go. And then we move into chapter 10, and sort of to emphasize the necessity of precise, complete compliance with all of the ritual laws that we've read about up to this point, and maintaining, again, this decontaminated status. This chapter preserves a brief story, a brief episode of the death of two of Aaron's sons, Nadav and Avihu, because they do something improper. They make an improper incense offering, and they are struck down by God's fire. So as we look at the chapter, there's actually four things going on here. You have the death of these two men, and prematurely, obviously, in the first seven verses. And then you get some regulations about prohibiting priests from consuming alcoholic or intoxicating beverages prior to officiating in the ritual, in the cult, in the tabernacle. And some people, because that little, that's verses 8 through 11, some people assume that because we have those three verses follow the Nadav and Avihu tragedy, that Nadav and Avihu were drunk. Yeah, I don't take that view. I think there's nothing in the text that can actually make that direct accusation, but there's still a logic to the beverage prohibition. We'll get to that. And then after verse 11, you have sort of a restatement of the requirement that priests eat the portions of the sacrifices that they're allowed to eat within specified areas, again, of sacred space, of the holy ground that is the tabernacle complex. And then lastly, the chapter ends with Moses' instructions to Aaron and a little bit of a problem regarding the disposition of the sin offering that had been brought by the people as part of the dedication of the tabernacle. And we'll get to what the problem was there. And, you know, an explanation that Moses accepts that some, you know, wonder if it's really satisfactory or not, but we'll get to that. But essentially what you have happen in this chapter is you have an object lesson of the importance, in other words, God's, you know, ultra low level of tolerance for contaminating sacred space and for not going through the proper procedures. And then you also have sort of supplemental content to that to remind the priests, okay, to do your duties correctly and to not mess up, don't drink alcohol before you're going to, it's your turn to officiate. Make sure that you eat, you know, the proper portion of the sacrifice. And not only that, but eat it where it should be eaten. Again, there's just these little sort of re-emphasized stipulations, because the lesson is pretty simple. Don't be like Nadav and Avi, you know, or else you're going to wind up dead. You know, I was going to say toast, I guess almost literally they were toast, but that's the big lesson. Just reminding you of their example. Don't be like this. Don't let this happen to you. So let's jump in here to the actual violation here. And I'll read the first few verses here of chapter 10. It says, "Now Nadav and Avihu, the sons of Aaron, each took his censer and put fire in it and laid incense on it and offered," the ESV has, "unauthorized fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded them. And fire came out from before the Lord," there's that phrase again, "and consumed them, and they died before the Lord. Then Moses said to Aaron, 'This is what the Lord has said. Among those who are near me, I will be sanctified, and before all the people, I will be glorified.' And Moses called Mishael and Elzaphan, the sons of Uziel, the uncle of Aaron, and said to them, 'Come near. Carry your brothers away from the front of the sanctuary and out of the camp.' So they came near and carried them in their coats out of the camp, as Moses had said." Again, they're trying to avoid touching a corpse, which would contaminate them. "And Moses said to Aaron and Eleazar and Ithamar, his sons, 'Do not let the hair of your heads hang loose, and do not tear your clothes, lest you die and wrath come upon all the congregation. But let your brothers, the whole house of Israel, bewail the burning that the Lord has kindled. And do not go outside the entrance of the tent of meeting, lest you die. For the anointing oil of the Lord is upon you.' And they did according to the word of Moses." Now, those are the first seven verses, and sort of what's memorable about this chapter. Again, some of these instructions can basically be summed up into don't mourn. Don't do some of the mourning things. You know, go to your house and rip your clothes and all that kind of stuff. You stay right here. And you don't do any of that. So we'll get to that as well. But let's go back to the beginning of the passage, where the two sons of Aaron take the censer and put fire in it. It's a term that just means coals of fire, and lay incense on it. So they're going to sprinkle something on it, of course, to create, you know, the not only the scent, but also the smoke, you know, for the burning incense. But they offer, quote, unauthorized fire. More literally, it would be strange fire. I think that's the way the King James renders it. They offer unauthorized fire before the Lord, which is a good translation because of the following line, which he had not commanded them. So they do something that they were not commanded to do. It sort of befuddled people, and it is sort of a somewhat difficult scene to sort of figure out, you know, what exactly did they do? The Hebrew here is Esh Zara, alien fire, strange fire. Again, unauthorized is a translation that picks up on the line that follows. And it's legit, because they weren't commanded to do it. So the difficult word, Esh, fire, is clear, you know, something that's burning. The difficult word is Zara. So why is this act, and why is this burning of incense here, why is it alien or unauthorized? The text doesn't really specify the offense committed by the two priests, but it just says that they do something that had not been specifically ordained. In other words, it wasn't part of the procedure. Now, again, the apparent, I think, again, there's a way to sort of construct an answer here, and that's what I'm going to try to do. I'm going to go through some other passages and look for some of these parallel phrases, because I think if we do that, an answer sort of emerges as to what they did, what was offensive. And I think, again, generally speaking, we could say that what they do wrong was that Nadav and Avihu penetrate too far into the sanctuary. In other words, they went on to sacred space designated for the high priest in accord with a specific procedure. And they also could have brought, you know, coals for burning incense from an incorrect source, you know, where the coals were actually taken from. But I think the one thing that's more apparent is that they're doing something that the high priest was supposed to do and therefore was not prescribed to them, because they're not the high priest. And that procedure required them to penetrate too far into the sanctuary, into the sacred space. And that's what they did wrong. At least that's a sort of a core aspect of it. And the way you get that is to look at a parallel reference to this episode in Leviticus 16, 1 through 3. So I'm going to flip over there quickly and read the first three verses here of Leviticus 16. It says, "The Lord spoke to Moses after the death of the two sons of Aaron." So again, this scene is in retrospect. "When they drew near before the Lord and died, the Lord said to Moses, 'Tell Aaron, your brother, not to come at any time into the holy place inside the veil before the mercy seat that is on the ark, so that he may not die. So that suggests that perhaps Nadav and Avihu had penetrated the veil or gotten too close to it. Because again, the high priest is supposed to do this once a year. And that's what Leviticus 16 is about. So God's saying, look, you don't do this just any time. I'm going to tell you when you're supposed to do this, when you're supposed to offer incense on the altar of incense that is positioned, if you remember the layout of the tabernacle, it's positioned right in front of the veil behind which is the Ark of the Covenant. So I'm going to tell you when you're supposed to do that. So that, again, that's a hint that, you know, maybe very possibly this is what they had done. God continues in the rest of verse 2 in Leviticus 16. Well, I'll just read verse 2 over. The Lord said to Moses, tell Aaron, your brother, not to come at any time into the holy place inside the veil before the mercy seat that is on the ark, so that he may not die. For I will appear in the cloud over the mercy seat. Verse 3, but in this way, Aaron shall come into the holy place. You know, now this is how he should do it. With a bull from the herd for a sin offering and a ram for a burnt offering. And then it continues. So procedurally, not only is it the high priest that's supposed to go to this point and do a certain thing on a certain day of the calendar, but before doing it, you've got to bring the proper offerings, again, to decontaminate yourself and to sanctify the area. And there's no record of Nadav and Avihu preceding, you know, doing that, you know, to preemptively prepare the space or themselves for, again, penetrating that far into the sanctuary. And even if they had done it, they're not the ones supposed to be doing it. So they still would have created a problem. They still would have transgressed. But again, Leviticus 16 gives us a bit of an idea. If you continue on in Leviticus 16 without getting too much into the content, because we'll hit obviously Leviticus 16 at some point in the podcast, it says this in verse 11. Aaron shall present the bull as a sin offering for himself and shall make atonement for himself and for his house. Again, that, you know, in effect covers everybody, the priesthood, at least descended from Aaron. And he shall kill the bull as a sin offering for himself. And he shall take a censer full of coals of fire from the altar before the Lord and two handfuls of sweet incense beaten small, and he shall bring it inside the veil. So here we have a specific location for the coals from that they should be taken from this altar, this location, and then brought in, again, penetrating the sacred space to this point. Again, we don't see anything like that in Leviticus 10. It just says that Nadav and Avihu, the sons of Aaron, each took his censer and put fire in it, you know, coals of fire, and laid incense on it. Okay, and they offered unauthorized fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded them. So again, here in Leviticus 16, we have a specific procedure that mentions where you get the coals, you know, what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to precede your presence there with the blood offering and all this kind of stuff. And again, going back to Leviticus 16, after the proper procedure, verse 13 says, put the incense, he shall put the incense on the fire before the Lord, that the cloud of the incense may cover the mercy seat that is over the Ark of the Testimony. Why? So that he doesn't die. So you have this phrase, so that he may not die, repeated twice in Leviticus 16. And the context of Leviticus 16 as it opens is what happened to Nadav and Avihu. Because that's the way Leviticus 16 opens. The Lord spoke to Moses after the death of the two sons of Aaron. Basically, okay, here's what they did wrong. Here's, you know, you don't just go in any time and by implication anyway, but this is the way. Verse 3, Aaron shall come into the holy place. So I think it's a really strong suggestion that this is the problem with Nadav and Avihu, the penetration and the violation of the procedure. And of course, they weren't the ones supposed to be doing it anyway. So they weren't the ones commanded to do this. So I think that is what's going on here. Now, yet another parallel passage that, again, sort of alludes to some of these things in Exodus 30, verses 1 to 10. Let's read a little bit of that. It says, Exodus 30, starting in verse 1, you shall make an altar on which to burn incense. So now, these are the instructions about building the altar of incense that we just read about in Leviticus 16. You shall make it of acacia wood. It's this long. It's this wide. You know, we get the dimensions and all that. And it says in verse 6, and you shall put it in front of the veil that is above the Ark of the Testimony, in front of the mercy seat that is above the testimony where I will meet with you. So we know that's where it's positioned. Verse 7, And Aaron shall burn fragrant incense on it. Every morning when he dresses the lamps, he shall burn it. So he can burn incense on it, just on that. But when there's only one time a year when he's actually going to move beyond the veil, and incense is involved in that, but also, again, sanctifying the presence through the blood offering. Again, it's just a little hint that sort of helps frame the discussion of Leviticus 10, that you know, in verse 9 in Exodus 30 actually says, you shall not offer unauthorized incense. Ketoret zarah. There's that word zarah again. Again, the incense altar that's right in front of the veil, which obscures the ark from vision and frankly from your presence, that's only supposed to, you know, have incense burned on it in a certain way with coals from a certain place by a certain person. And again, you take all this back to Leviticus 10. I think it does frame the issue there. So I would say that Nadav and Avihu penetrate too far into sacred space that was meant only for the high priest. And not only had they not gone through the purification procedure that we just read about in Leviticus 16, but they also sort of kind of assumed they could do his job to offer incense, quote, before the Lord. Now, let's take a look at that language too. I want to say a little something about the before the Lord language. We read in verse 2 of Leviticus 10 that the fire that killed Nadav and Avihu came out from before the Lord. So the language before the Lord is the same as occurs in these related passages for the space at the veil where the altar of incense was. Curiously, though, the fire that emanated from the Lord's presence killed Nadav and Avihu after the fact of their violation. In other words, after they'd gone back out of the holy place, you know, like right after they get out of the tented area. That's either how we would read where they find the bodies, or they are struck with fire on the spot before the Lord and they manage to get out of the tented area, and then they die, you know, outside the area, because that's where the corpses are picked up. Their bodies are removed from, quote, in front of the sanctuary. So either they're struck with fire on the spot and they make it out, or God strikes them as soon as they leave the tented holy area. Again, there's a little bit of an ambiguity there, but the fire, again, originates from the divine presence. That much is clear. So it suggests, again, that the death and the corpse actually took place in its, you know, in finality terms, outside the holy tented area, the holy place. And then, of course, part of that is the most holy place, the inner sanctum. And that kind of makes sense, because a corpse would have defiled, you know, any sacred space, but it sort of removes death, at least in terms of the corpse, from the most holy area. Because we talked about this before with like blood, loss of blood and seminal emissions and things like that. Yahweh, you know, again, predominantly speaking, was associated with life, not death. Now, it was very clear that Yahweh had power over life and death. Again, work in both directions there. But he was the God of the living. He was the source of life. He was the creator, that kind of thing. So it could be, again, this is a bit speculative, it could be that the fact that they don't have to be picked up, the corpses don't have to be picked up in the actual tented holy place, might have been, again, sort of theological messaging that, you know, especially if God waits, you know, till they get outside to zap them, that this notion of, you know, I have to punish this violation, but I'm not a God of death. I'm a God of life, you know, and I don't want death to be associated with, you know, with me. I'm the living God and that sort of thing. So it could have had a sort of a peripheral object lesson other than the main object lesson, that don't screw up. Don't screw up the procedures. Don't presume to usurp duties of the high priest, so on and so forth. So who's the lesson for? There's an interesting phrase here that I think has kind of an interesting application for us. And that is in verse 3. It says, then Moses said to Aaron, this is what the Lord has said, quote, among those who are near me, I will be sanctified, and before all the people, I will be glorified. And Aaron held his peace. So there's a distinction here between the people generally, you know, that they're going to get the message and they're going to fear God. I will be glorified. But then there's this other group, those who are near me. Okay, among those who are near me, I will be sanctified. And of course, it's a reference to the priest, the priesthood. You know, that again, my presence needs to be protected from you, because you will profane it. You are lesser. You will bring impurity into you know, my presence. And again, it's the lesson of sacred space, that which is sanctified versus that which is common. But I think it's kind of interesting that the text, and again, for obvious reasons in the Old Testament context, draws this distinction between the masses and then the priests. The priests are karov, those who come near. they're special. They're different. You get the same language in Ezekiel 42 and Ezekiel's temple vision. You know, it's only the Karov priests that are near to God. They draw near because they're sanctified, so on and so forth. You have phrases like Karovim Ladonai. Those who draw near to me shall eat the holy offerings, again, in Ezekiel and different passages. So again, this distinction between priesthood and laity is what I'm getting at here. Because now, again, think about it. Put yourself in the mind of a first century Jew who knows the system and had been taught about the distinction between the priesthood and the laity. We don't have that anymore. That's foreign to the New Testament. Okay, you know, there's this concept of every believer is a priest. And that's the way everyone's looked at. So every believer, every follower of Yahweh, the entirety of the people of God, the masses here that can rightfully be called the people of God, every one of those are those who draw near and can draw near and ought to, and God wants them to. Again, we've read some of these passages before in Hebrews about boldly entering into the sacred space. So it's another, again, distinction that is illegitimate for today. I mean, and I don't mean to sort of pound too much on the idea of a priesthood or a professional ministry. I could go off in lots of directions about vocational ministry, pro and con and all that sort of stuff. And this isn't really the podcast episode for that. But I think there's a line that's crossed when Christian service, let's just be as broad as we possibly can, when those who are in full-time Christian service, vocational Christian service, make too much of the distinction that their office and even their clothing and where they can stand and walk in a given church service, how that distances them from the laity. And that's where a lot of this priest stuff in Christianity comes from. It comes from a reading back to Leviticus and to the theocracy. Well, newsflash, okay, the theocracy is over with, and it was planned to become obsolete. So I don't know why we have to sort of bring the baggage along. This is just something that I think is an important element of biblical theology. You know, and it really touches on the whole divine counsel thing about God originally wanting a family. He wanted a family who worked for him at the beginning. There were no priests and laity distinction. Everybody was in the presence of God. Everybody was humans were supposed to be part of the divine council group that helped God get things done, either, you know, in the invisible world or, of course, the visible world, the world of humanity, the world of embodiment. We all worked, God wanted us to all work for the same company, okay, Divine Council Incorporated, you know, whatever you want to call it. And it was a family business. The ground was equal, the ground was level. And then, of course, that, you know, goes its way. And when we get these reinstallments of the kingdom of God, well, then God institutes a theocracy. But even that's planned to be obsolete because that's how the New Testament salvation history plan plays out. So you get in the New Testament and it says, we're all priests. Every believer is a priest. Again, I think there's a point to that. I think it actually means something. And for us to blur it or obscure it by, again, there's nothing wrong with elevating certain people in terms of respect. You know, Paul talks about that as well, and the writer of Hebrews does too, you know, about respecting the elders and whatnot. But ontologically, and in terms of worship, in terms of nearness to God, there is no distinction. Okay, the only thing that distinguishes them is, frankly, responsibility. Okay, it's not nearness to God, it's accountability. And I think when we get away from that, when we start to, again, professionalize the ministry or super sanctify it, we're getting away from an important element of New Testament theology and, frankly, biblical theology. So in verse 4, going back to Leviticus 10 here, we read verse 4 about carrying the bodies in their coats and so on and so forth. And again, that was done. That was necessary to avoid contamination. And it's also necessary for Aaron's cousins to remove the bodies of the dead priests because the two remaining sons of Aaron, Eleazar and Ithamar, had just been consecrated as priests. And so they can't be the ones to carry the corpses out because what happens if they defile themselves? Well, like, who's going to do the priestly stuff? Because Nadav and Avihu are dead. So again, we get the cousins here in on the act, you know, to take care of the problem. And again, that's why they're singled out, because we've just lost half the priesthood in this episode. Now, the second section, again, is about intoxicants. In verse 8, we'll just read that. The Lord spoke to Aaron, saying, drink no wine or strong drink, you or your sons with you, when you go into the tent of meeting, lest you die. It will be a statute forever throughout your generations. Now, again, this has been read as having something to do with Nadav and Avihu. And I'm not saying that that can't be the case. I'm just saying I think a better case is to go to Leviticus 16 and say the problem was, you know, penetrating too far and not doing the proper procedures and usurping at something that was for the high priest. And you could say, well, maybe they were drunk. Maybe that's what led to those bad decisions. Okay. You know, you could say that. I don't think that that is the explanation though, which, you know, on occasion you'll read, but just generally, I mean, intoxicants, you know, alcoholic beverages are forbidden to the priest precisely because drinking them would impair their abilities, their faculties, their ability to perform their tasks. They would not be able to do what they needed to do, or they might be blinded or their senses dulled to distinguishing between the sacred and the profane, and whether it's an object or some place they're supposed to walk or not walk. Again, this is just a precautionary note because of the concept of sacred space, and because in this day and age, you could be struck down, just like Nadav and Avihu were, for messing up. And so, the larger lesson is don't be like this. Okay, don't do this. You get the third section of Leviticus 10, requirement that priests eat their allotted portions within the specified areas. At verse 12, it says, Moses spoke to Aaron, to Eleazar, and Ithamar, his surviving sons, take the grain offering that is left of the Lord's food offerings, eat it unleavened beside the altar, for it is most holy. You shall eat it in a holy place, because it is your due and your sons' due from the Lord's offerings, for so I am commanded. But the breast that is waved and the thigh that is contributed to you, you shall eat in a clean place, you and your sons, you know, so on and so forth. Again, we get these regulations of where to eat it, what to eat, you know, that sort of thing. Again, the point is the same. Follow the procedures. We've already given you the procedures, you know, prior revelation, scripture here leading up to Leviticus 10. It's all been laid out. So follow the rules. Don't violate sacred space. Now, you'd think, you know, that would sort of be the end of it, but the chapter actually doesn't end there. It ends with sort of a little kind of mini episode that, you know, was possibly another close call, but, you know, it was averted. So let me just read that and we'll finish up here in Leviticus 10. Verse 16 says, now Moses diligently inquired about the goat of the sin offering, and behold, it was burned up. And he was angry with Eleazar and Ithamar, the surviving sons of Aaron. I love that line. These are the only ones that are left. And now Moses is mad at them. Like, uh-oh. 17, why have you not eaten the sin offering in the place of the sanctuary, since it is a thing most holy and has been given to you, that you may bear the iniquity of the congregation to make atonement for them before the Lord? Why haven't you followed this procedure? Behold, its blood was not brought into the inner part of the sanctuary. You certainly ought to have eaten it in the sanctuary as I commanded. And the answer is, verse 19, Aaron said to Moses, behold, today they have offered their sin offering and their burnt offering before the Lord, and yet such things as these have happened to me. If I had eaten the sin offering today, would the Lord have approved? And when Moses heard that, he approved. He was okay. Now, the point is, there's a reference here back to the rule, which is in Leviticus 6, okay, about bringing the blood inside the sanctuary and so on and so forth, okay? It says, but no sin offering may be eaten from which any blood is brought into the tent of meeting for expiation in the sanctuary. Any such shall be consumed in fire. So that's the problem here. So since the blood of this sin offering had not been brought inside the sanctuary, the proper portions of the sacrifice, you know, were to be eaten by the priest at this specific location. Now, Aaron sort of excuses this. He excuses the failure of the priests to do what they should have done by explaining to Moses that his sons thought that they shouldn't eat of the sacrifice because of what had happened with Nadav and Avihu. In other words, even though they were forbidden from mourning gestures and from leaving, you know, the sacred area and going to their house to mourn, even though that had been forbidden to them, Aaron says, look, you know, they're in mourning anyway because of what had happened. And so, you know, they just thought that they shouldn't eat of the sacrifice. They shouldn't participate. It's not a happy time. It's not an occasion for, you know, having sort of a celebratory meal with God. And then the chapter ends, when Moses heard that, he approved. You know, okay, I get it. In other words, Moses accepts it. We don't read, you know, any more about, you know, God being upset with that rationale or Moses having to take that to the Lord or anything like that. So again, it was, you know, possibly a close call because it's true. They didn't do what they normally should have done, but this is what Aaron says to, you know, we could say it's an excuse, maybe, but yeah, I think there is coherence to it. Whether, you know, we can sit here and judge Aaron and say, well, maybe he made that up. Maybe that wasn't it. But again, let's give him the benefit of the doubt, you know, cause the text doesn't rail on him, you know, for anything additional. Okay. It wasn't a happy time and they just decided we're not going to pretend it is a happy time. This is the only way we can express our mourning and we feel bad about what happened. So that's okay. Again, that's the way the chapter answers it or ends and answers the issue. So just to sort of summarize here again with just a few points, teaching points, application points, whatever you want to call them. The whole chapter really focuses on the importance of sacred space. The idea that Yahweh's space needs to be distinguished from other space. It's not just theory anymore. Okay, it changed from theory to reality when two guys got fried. Okay, it's not just theoretical. And the people, the priesthood, and all the people know this now. So it's going to strike fear into them, and it's going to put a seriousness to the matter. We need to learn the lesson God wants us to learn. We need to learn the theology God wants us to learn, because we don't want this to ever happen again. And, you know, again, that's the point that's reinforced by the chapter. Again, it's a good life lesson. You know, why I keep repeating the same sorts of errors in our own Christian life. And, you know, we know what we're supposed to do and we don't. Well, you know, sometimes God, you know, has to let us suffer. Sometimes it has to hurt for the lesson to sink in. And again, that's sort of the point of Leviticus 10. The second thought, again, even though we don't need or have a physical temple, sacred space can still be violated. And you say, well, where do you get that, Mike? Well, in 1 Corinthians 11, remember, this is the Lord's Supper chapter. Paul says, because of something you're doing in connection with the Lord's Supper observance, some are sick and some have died prematurely. So the implication is that God is holding people accountable in some way for some offense in 1 Corinthians 11. And if any of you have ever gone up to my blog and, you know, read my take on what's going on there, I don't think it's about unconfessed sin. I think it's about what Paul actually tells us in the context that some of the poor are being mistreated. They used to have a celebratory feast, a love feast, in conjunction with observing the Lord's Supper in New Testament times. And Paul's big gripe is, look, those of you who don't need the food, you have enough. You're crowding out the poor, or you're neglecting them, or you're doing something where they're not getting enough to eat, but you're just, you know, sort of filling your faces at this thing, and that just isn't right. If you want to have a meal, go home, because you have the goods. You have enough, but some people don't. And so this is really a blessing to them to be able to eat a full meal like this, shared goods again. And, you know, to them, it's not just a luxury. It's really important. So that's the problem in 1 Corinthians 11. And apparently God, you know, was judging that. You know, in 2 Corinthians 6, God talks about, you know, how, you know, through Paul, that we are the temple of God, and we shouldn't be partnering again with the powers of darkness and just people who are not loyal to Yahweh and so on and so forth. And again, the 2 Corinthians 6 talks about some of the ill effects, you know, some of the polluting effects that can have. So even though we don't have sacred space that's ground, and even though we are, our bodies as believers are indwelt by the Spirit, even though we are sacred space, there are things we can do to violate sacred space even today. Again, that's the point. And then lastly, the line about among those who are near me, I kind of like, because I'm a big believer in the priesthood of the believer idea, because it's biblical theology. So we need to take care if we are in vocational ministry, for those who were under in church that you know, have a vocational ministry, we need to help them remember this and say, look, it's not about spirituality. It's not about being nearer to God than someone who's not in vocational ministry. It's about accountability. It's about responsibility. You're no more sanctified than I am. You have no more of the Spirit dwelling in you than I do. Okay, we are all believer priests. Okay, we can all be ones that draw near to the Lord. It's not about, again, spirituality or standing before God. It's about these other things, you know, accountability and responsibility. So I think we can take some good lessons from Leviticus 10. It's an interesting chapter, but also I think a fairly practical one too.
How much of God did the Jews fear? I mean, back in Leviticus 9, when the fire came out before the Lord and consumed the burnt offerings, and here the fire came out again before the Lord and consumed the brothers, I mean, that's got to be pretty scary. I mean, and then they fall to their faces in the end of Leviticus 9, when the Jews fall to their face. I mean, how scary and scared of God were they?
Well, I personally think, you know, I would not say that every passage that refers to the fear of the Lord is not about mere reverence, because that's the way these passages usually get taken. All that refers to revering God and respecting God. Well, it certainly does, but I think some of them, for sure, because of this, you know, these kind of contexts, makes the fear of the Lord to be even more than just reverence. That they're living at a day and time when God could directly intervene and make a point like this. And I think they did, especially the nearer you were, I think, to the Mosaic period, the more prone you probably would have been to something like this. And I'm not saying these sorts of things didn't happen later in Israel's history. They did. But yeah, I think that was part of it, that there was legitimate concern about your bodily well-being if you were out of step with God, that would have been part of the way you process that, or at least you know, should have. And I think a lot of the godly Israelites would have, that God can judge us this way. And the New Testament, this actually isn't foreign. I mean, like you know, John says, there is a sin unto death. In other words, there's a point at which, when if you persist in sin, God is no longer interested in forgiveness or your, you know, that kind of process. God has to intervene and say, okay, you know, we're past the point of no return. I need to take this believer, you're still a believer, but I need to take this believer home, because John is writing that to Christians. I mean, there is this sense, this the writer of Hebrews, it's a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. Now, you could say, well, that's about eschatological judgment, and it sort of is, but there's still this sense that God will act. You know, you're not going to, you know, it's not just theory, it's not just passive, you know, that sort of idea. 1 Corinthians 11, I think, is a good case, you know, where there apparently is, you know, some sort of judgment going on because of what they were doing. This is not foreign to the New Testament. You know, look at, we went through Acts, Ananias and Sapphira. Apparently, you know, God decides, well, we need to have an object lesson here, you know, and it's not indiscriminate. It's not repetitive. It's not frequent. The fact that it isn't frequent, you know, I think again, makes the whole notion of, you know, God looking at the situation. Okay. We need an object lesson. We've crossed a line here. People need to be reminded, and better one or two to make the point than something more drastic, you know, that kind of thing. So I think this was, you know, part of their theology, and it wasn't just mere behave, you know, or respect or that kind of thing, even though that's certainly a part of it. You don't lose that. But this other thing over there is sort of the elephant in the room when it comes to how they're thinking about what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And remember, Ananias, Acts, that's New Testament.
Yeah.
I mean, that's after Christ. Yeah. And he's still.
Yeah. Yeah. Same with the Corinthian church. You know, I mean, you have these instances. Again, the sin unto death. I mean, this thinking is not utterly foreign to the New Testament after the cross. It just isn't.
All right, Mike. Well, is there anything going on that you'd like to mention for this week?
Nothing new to report. We're, you know, I think we'll wait to issue some reminders about some things that are coming up, you know, for the next episode, we're actually sort of on top of them. But, you know, nothing sort of intervening in the meantime, though.
Okay. And next week, we're going to continue with Leviticus?
Yep, Leviticus 11.
Okay, well, good deal. All right, Mike, well, we appreciate it. And I just want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.